This is the story of an iconic fighter plane. Built by the hands of ordinary men and women, behind closed doors and in secret corners, of one city in one country during a time of war. I'm Tuppence Middleton, and this is Spitfire, the People's Plane. In the early part of the Second World War, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was attacking Britain. Other European countries were under occupation. Britain would be next, unless the planes were ready to stop the raids. But already, three devastating bombing raids had halted Spitfire production, the fastest and nimblest plane on the planet. But if there were no planes, there was no defence. The big plan was to disperse construction far and wide into shops, garages, factories and bus depots all over the city of Southampton on the south coast of England. But it was a race against time.
Hendy's garage went first. Then, as this simple solution caught on, down went Carey and Lambert's, Wadham's, Lothers and Seawood's.
This is Cyril Russell, an apprentice at Supermarine, 19 years old and right in the thick of it.
Then, like the spreading fingers of a hand, the search for places out of Southampton and its dangers went fanwise, north to Reading, Winchester and Newbury, and west to Hursley, Salisbury and Trowbridge. The effort was remarkable.
In this episode, we'll continue to follow the race to complete construction as assembly of the Spitfire spreads ever outward to smaller towns and villages. As each new site was found, each was a new potential target for the Luftwaffe. As the dust settles from the bombed-out factories, the search for premises picks up speed. The temporary management HQ on the top floor of the Polygon Hotel is a hive of activity. There was Wilf Elliott, the works superintendent, the works manager Len Gooch, and two of Max Beaverbrook's own men, sent from the Ministry of Aircraft Production, to keep an eye on proceedings. A mismatched pair called Whitehead and Cowley.
The first day in the Polygon got things moving.
And as usual, Dennis Webb, the charming but forthright spare parts manager, was at the forefront of the action.
The next move was to send senior staff men out in various directions to hunt for suitable buildings within 60 miles. The owners were phoned and our intention to requisition made known. Any obstruction occurred, the big guns were brought to bear in the shape of Cowley, or Whitehead. Cowley was a great character, Canadian, always calm and unruffled with a great sense of humour. I think we all liked him immensely. Whitehead was a different kettle of fish, and I don't think anyone cared for him much. I certainly didn't.
Businesses weren't always keen to give up their precious space to the Ministry of Aircraft Production, but Beaverbrook's boys were there to twist arms, and twist they did. One venue in Winchester had already been requisitioned by the Ministry of Food, until Cowley picked up the phone.
"What have you got stored there?" went the slow Canadian drawl. Silence. Then, "Pineapples?" with a rising inflection of exasperation. "Jesus, do you think you can win this goddamn war with pineapples?" We got the premises the next day.
When the mayor of Salisbury stuck his oar in, objecting to the requisitioning of the Wiltshire and Dorset bus garage, Cowley was straight on the phone.
"Tell me, Mr. Mayor," said Cowley, "I believe you are the patron of the local Spitfire Fund, is that true?"
"Oh, yes,"
came the obvious, very proud reply. "Well," said Cowley with his inimitable drawl, "may I suggest that you close that fund and start another, to erect a statue to the mayor who thought Spitfires weren't necessary," and quietly put the receiver down. Capitulation followed soon afterwards.
But of course, it wasn't just the premises that had to be arranged. The workers had to find their place in this new system too. Apprentice Cyril went where the winds of Supermarine blew him.
On the Tuesday and Wednesday, I worked on fuselages at Hendy's Garages, and on Thursday, I was sent to Seawoods Motors, which provided just enough room in its upper floors for our machines. As our wheeling machines, benches and other equipment were all relatively small and easily moved, it was only natural that we would be pushed around until things settled. We moved from Seawoods to an agricultural showroom at Chandler's Ford on the 22nd of October 1940.
Chandler's Ford is a town around 6 miles north of Southampton. The owner of the agricultural showrooms did all they could to stop their business being commandeered by the ministry, but to no avail.
The requisitioning officer had to bring in his own labour gang and police attendants while the machinery was removed from the building and left on the grass forecourt. Requisitioning of premises were not all smooth actions. Some of the occupants objected furiously. I remember at the Barnes steamroller factory at Southwick, the owner of the premises took the wheels off his heavy lumbering giants and yelled blue murder to his MP. In the end, he had to give way, although he was allowed to keep one part for himself.
Winter was creeping on. The nights were getting longer, and being on the road after dark was dangerous as the air raids continued.
We had to make the evening dusk scramble for home before the sirens interfered with our journey or left our families wondering.
Cyril found lodging in Chandler's Ford itself. Although only 6 short miles from Southampton, it was the first time the 19-year-old had lived away from home.
During those winter months, our agricultural showroom unit was cold as ice, especially after dark when we would work on until 8 p.m. We had a few scares from the German raiders when bombs were dropped in the general area, by accident or by design, and one night, a night fighter caught a bomber less than a mile east of us, and it exploded in the air. It was such an explosive force that we wondered how any night fighter could escape the blast.
Despite the effort spent in relocating the Spitfire works out of the way of the threat of German bombs, Britain was at war, and so nowhere was really safe. Sometimes, whether on target or miles off course, the Luftwaffe punched through Britain's defences. Local historian Alan Matlock has uncovered this secret history piece by piece.
It was thought that the Germans had worked out where the dispersal sites were when an attack was successful, but probably it's more likely that a lone bomber on his way back with a few bombs that he hadn't dropped elsewhere was just offloading them so that he could get back to northern France more quickly.
One of the dispersal sites was in the sleepy medieval market town of Bishop's Waltham, 11 miles from Southampton. It is an unlikely target for a German attack, but it was hit. The exact address of these stores had been lost to history, but Alan tracked it down to a Victorian brickworks called Blanchard's.
It was one of the few dispersal sites that were bombed. Lots of people around the town witnessed it, and there are accounts, one by a young lad who was herding some cows, another by a lady called Betty. And they all mention how when the German plane came in, very low, they could tell it was a German, they could see the plane, and when he dropped his bombs, the sky turned red. And the reason, of course, was all the brick dust that had accumulated over the years going up into the air and turning the air red. Our old friend Dennis Webb was called by his boss to go out to the Bishop's Waltham brickyard to see if their surplus leading edges had been damaged. Webb says, Pratt and I, that's his boss, drove up to the entrance where the usual group of gawkers
had gathered, plus some police and air raid wardens. I was somewhat dismayed to see a notice, keep out, unexploded bomb. Pratt turned to me and said, all right with you, Webb? I croaked out, I suppose so. And we went in. All the parts were undamaged, and we could see that almost immediately. But Pratt went on poking around, wanting to see where the bombs had gone in, while I did my best to stop wetting myself. I was heartily relieved when we left the site.
As the dispersal gathered pace, the workforce continued to grow and grow. All sorts of jobs needed doing, and the help came from anywhere and everywhere, from the highest in society to the lowest.
We're off to Park Place. There is a country house called Park Place, very close to little country town of Wickham, about 15 miles east of Southampton. And it turned out that it was owned by Sir James Bird.
Sir James Bird, or Jimmy, as he was known, was the original managing director of Supermarine. He had retired some years ago, but came out of retirement to help Spitfire production in its moment of need.
He had an extension built, a very long, narrow hut. And women from the Women's Voluntary Service in Wickham would come from the town, and their job was to sort rivets. And you wouldn't think that that was much of a job, but the rivets are incredibly varied. There are different colours, there are different lengths, there are different shapes to the ends of them.
Flat rivets for the wings, domed rivets to the rear, heat-resistant rivets for under the mighty exhaust, thousands, millions of tiny rivets.
Why they were mixed up in the first place, I'm not sure, but there's a lovely photo of the ladies sitting on a workbench and piles of rivets and different pots to put them in. But if you look carefully at the photo, there's a poster on the wall. A little tuck stops a lot of work.
These tiny rivets would have been loaded onto trucks and delivered all across the dispersal area. Riveting was good work if you could get it. It was one of the many jobs that often fell to women. One of the places where the riveting compressors roared away night and day was the requisitioned Sunlight Laundry. Two women keen to get work there are sisters, Florrie and Daisy.
Florrie and Daisy had been working for British American Tobacco, and they could pick up a bunch of cigarettes and know that they had got 20 in their hand. They heard that there was work to be had at the newly acquired Sunlight Laundry, making Spitfire parts. The pay was better, so they moved up there and were trained on the job.
They expected better pay with Supermarine and perhaps more interesting work. What they might not have expected was an opportunity for romance.
Florrie and Daisy, they met Ray and Reg, who were aircraft fitters, got very close, got engaged, in fact. And there are photos of them on a picnic. That was their engagement time.
In wartime, opportunities for joy and celebration were scarce. So when they came around, everyone joined in.
They got married at the local church, St James's Church, and they were amazed when they came out of the church on the Saturday afternoon and the road was full of their workmates from the Sunlight Laundry and the other dispersal units up Winchester Road who'd been given the afternoon off to see them, the Spitfire sweethearts, come out of church. Possibly the only time they'd had a break like that.
The newlyweds couldn't have their reception at the church hall. Why? Because it too had been requisitioned and was being used to make Spitfire fuel tanks. So they found somewhere else for their double wedding reception, with their double bridesmaids, their two cakes, and a shared first dance.
I think it was a very special time. The local newspaper was headlined Spitfire Sweethearts, and that name stuck with them throughout their life. And Reg and Daisy have a memorial which is still to be seen outside St James's Church.
The Spitfires were coming together, one small piece at a time, but all these separate parts still need to be made into whole planes. Cyril Russell was one of those involved in the final assembly. He'd been moved to a tiny hangar at High Post Flying Club, where all the various parts were being finally bolted, screwed, or welded together. The hangar was utterly unsuitable for Spitfire construction, but they made it work.
The hangar was just large enough to take three Spitfires, providing the first two had their tail ends pushed into the opposite corners so the third could get between them, and its wings blocked the other two in. For canteen facilities, we had to trek half a mile across an airfield. It used to take roughly 2.5 days of day and night shifts to make a single Spitfire. And with three on the go together, the overall effect used to be 6 aircraft per week produced. Despite the dangerous manhandling of the wings, we never had an accident, which, in the circumstances, was quite remarkable.
The big plan had worked. The great dispersal of Spitfire production in the autumn of 1940 and beyond had happened. Hidden away in small, scattered communities, hundreds of people took the risk of becoming a target themselves to build the plane which would help turn the tide of the war. Three quarters of a century on, the question remains, just how successful was it? Here is Dennis Webb, manager of spare parts, remember? He was scrutinising the official reports and taking notes and coming to his own conclusions.
The quarterly report for March 1941, 6 months after the raid, reads, "Great difficulty has been encountered in transferring skilled men from Southampton to the various dispersal centres. This has resulted in considerable retardation of production."
If we were to stop history here, then it would have all been for nothing. But Dennis Webb goes on to tell a different story.
By early 1941, the first stage dispersal was complete, and all requisitioned laundries, garages, bus stations, glove factories, steamroller works and strawberry basket works were producing Spitfire parts and components.
It's a story of rivets and screws, of wood, metal and stretched canvas, a story of wings and propellers and a Merlin engine, built, assembled and ready to fly.
By the end of 1941, we had got back to pre-dispersal output, and by the middle of 1942, we had surpassed it.
And just as a plane is made of thousands of tiny parts, each one essential, so the building of it took thousands of people, each with their part to play. And thanks to these people, eventually, it all came together.
The legend, which seems to have built up about the splendid forward planning which made the dispersal such a success, really needs correcting. I can say quite definitely that it was not pre-planning that made the dispersal successful, but the quite marvellous improvisation and hard work that did the trick.
Next time, it's time for the planes to take to the air. We hear about the men and the pioneering women who delivered the Spitfire, from the factories to their military posts, all as the threat of further conflict grew.
One of the BBC World Service's most popular podcasts this year has been the second season of 13 Minutes to the Moon. It tells the story of the dramatic rescue of Apollo 13 following a catastrophic explosion in the depths of space, featuring the voices of the astronauts and engineers themselves. But we never got to hear the end of the story because the presenter, Kevin Fong, just happens to have a day job as a doctor, now working in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we paused production to let him focus on that. However, the climactic final episode is now nearly ready for launch, and it'll be available in the 13 Minutes to the Moon feed from the 8th of June. In the meantime, if you haven't already heard the rest of the award-winning series, now is the perfect time to catch up. Just search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts.